mobile phones has been spying on anyone from regular citizens to heads of states and journalists. The audio and video of one's phone can be turned on without the owner knowing it. And everything can be accessed, from old messages to notes on your phone contacts. Nothing is safe. How dangerous is this? And what can be done to stop it? We will be taking a look at all of this on The Spotlight.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad Al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula O'Dean, and Anas Al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. Al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus, yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Author and researcher Daniel Gengen out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'm going to start this off in Barcelona. And Daniel, we have heard for years that smartphones can listen in and even see its owners without them knowing. Tell me what is different about this Pegasus spyware and what makes it so much more dangerous.
Is able to be installed on the phone without the owner doing anything. It can be installed remotely without the owner having any idea that it actually is on their phone. It can access their messages, can access their camera, their microphone, and is basically able to have full control over all the content on their phone, which makes it very dangerous. Now, the issue with Pegasus had also been raised previously. This is it is not new that what we know about the software. What is new now is, of course, the extent of how many people individually in higher positions have been targeted, which of course creates a completely new reality of a very global surveillance that is being. The record has its source in the Zionist entity where it has been, where this software has been developed with the backing of the Zionist regime directly.
Let me go over to Ramiro. Daniel just said something about the Zionist entity, and I want to pick up on that as far as this being an Israeli company and the danger of that in general, because we know that it is a regime that does not abide by any type of international law at all. Ramiro, your take on that side of it.
That's exactly right. I think the Pegasus software is extremely dangerous. It is part and parcel of the Zionist method of control using intelligence abroad, the founders of the quote-unquote State of Israel understood the importance of controlling key aspects of infrastructure and trade, controlling the key trade routes of society, hence why occupied Palestine, or the State of Israel, is where it is today, because it sits at the key intersections of infrastructure in the Middle East. Now, applying that same logic to the 21st century, what are the key infrastructure points? The internet, WhatsApp, Google, Facebook, these are the points of infrastructure that are used all over the world daily by every single person. I don't know a single person who doesn't have a smartphone, who doesn't have these apps. And so now we can consider these applications, these devices, as key infrastructure. And yet, once again, the Zionists have taken control of this key infrastructure, control the information that flows in and out, and see and monitor anybody who's in any way speaking out against their client governments. In Latin America, for example, one of the more lesser reported stories is that the Israeli government has been selling Pegasus, the Zionists have been selling Pegasus to the governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Colombia, three of which are key drug trading countries that are involved in the drug trade in the United States. And this software has been used to monitor, track, and assassinate activists, journalists who have spoken out against the crimes of the Mexican government, the Honduran government, the Colombian government, in collaboration with Mossad, with the IDF, with Israeli intelligence. So this is something that affects the entire world. It affects key infrastructure because everyone uses smartphone technology. And I think it's, again, part and parcel of the Zionist strategy of controlling the key points of infrastructure to make sure that nobody speaks out against their allies.
Daniel, your take on what Ramir just said about as far as being selling this to certain governments. I want to look at the way that this malware can be used to control dissent, control whether we're talking about journalists, activists, and even sometimes heads of states. As we talked about earlier, that with this spyware, everything is accessible, which of course means very private information that could lead to blackmail.
Dangerous in so many ways, especially because it is not only a tool that was developed by the Zionists, was developed by people who have a tie to the Zionist regime and was approved by it. It was also promoted by the Zionist regime to be sold to different regimes, but also it is being sold, it is disseminated and used in different ways. And even in, if I remember correctly, in 2018, there was an article in the Zionist newspaper that there was an investigative report on how many countries and how many regimes have been using this particular software to spy, but not only to spy on journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, academics, but also to coerce and threaten and blackmail people or to persecute minorities. So this can effectively, of course, lead to an increase of state violence. And can have drastic implications for individuals and for population groups, which is what makes it so dangerous on so many levels. But of course, it is part and parcel of the Zionist strategy, because as much of other technologies and mechanisms that the Zionist regime is selling globally, it has consolidated itself globally as a force for the creation of methods of population containment and control that had been practiced and tested on Palestinians for at least the last 73 years. So much of the surveillance is tested in Palestine, and in many ways, Pegasus is just one of the examples of the transnationalization of the violence against Palestinians, where Israel is using Palestinians and developing all sorts of methods that will help oppress people elsewhere and coerce people in key positions to effectively coerce them into making decisions, which gives, again, the Zionist regime even much more power, potentially.
I mean, Romero, I mean, would you say that this cyber surveillance is a new weapon? Obviously, that is quite dangerous. And what needs to be done in order to control it, just as we have other weapons that there are various laws with it? What do you think about that? What can be done?
Cyber surveillance is definitely a weapon, not only because it serves to monitor your actions, to make sure that you stay in line, to make sure that you don't criticize Israel, to make sure that you don't criticize the U.S., the Western countries. But it also serves as a weapon, a mass weapon of distraction. Here in the United States, where I'm speaking to you now from, every day there are new applications, methods, devices, content designed to distract and miseducate the population, to keep people misinformed, to not care about what's going on around the world. And I think that this cyber surveillance, it plays a role as well when we're talking about predictive behavior and data. Based on the words that you type on your phone, based on the words that you say in conversations with people, the big tech companies, which are 100% in collaboration with the Zionist Entity of Israel, they use that data to predict your behavior and also to influence your behavior, to make it seem as if you want something that you really don't, to put content in your face and to want a desired outcome. And this is also used in the political sphere as well, where we see social media surveillance being used to promote regime change efforts in Cuba, to promote regime change efforts in the Middle East and all over the world. And so I think that cyber surveillance and spying and hacking is a huge threat, not only in terms of collecting data and keeping people in a low vibrational state of distraction, but also in terms of making you want something that you really didn't want. And I think in terms of correcting this, I think it really comes down to values. It really comes down to having progressive anti-imperialist governments realign the values of a society. I think Iran is doing a great job at that. I think countries like Nicaragua, Venezuela are doing a great job of that as well, where they're creating their own independent media companies, their own smartphone technology, their own devices that are free from some of the filth that we see in the Western societies, free from the hacking. And so I think it's really up to the anti-imperialist countries like Iran, like Russia, like China, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, to develop independent technologies and infrastructure so that they can't get to our technologies to begin with, to create things that aren't designed to distract us and keep us in a low state. Okay. And so I think that's it.
Well, what about that, Daniel? He just said about the, which I like, the weapons of mass distraction. And he talked about the anti-imperialist front. But as you know, the anti-imperialist front is continually under pressure, whether we're talking about economic sanctions or we're talking about in the media war, the soft war. And on the other hand, so when you're still using some of their platforms, as we saw with Press TV basically being shut down and taken off of .com, so where do we go with this? On the one hand, the pressure is on economically. On the other hand, if we use their platforms or use their smartphones, now we see the situation with actually the Israeli regime being in control of most of it.
Rather a dilemma, and I agree that there need to be new ways to be found in order for anti-imperialist factions to develop different kinds of, maybe through a collaboration of alternative media. I mean, Press TV has, this example you mentioned, when Press TV's domain was bought, Press TV managed very swiftly to use a different domain and still to continue its program without any major interruption, which showed that even those threats or direct forms of intimidation coming from the U.S. regime have been able to, Press TV was able to circumvent them. But of course, the danger is there. And effectively, there would need to be different ways to find alternative platforms that can be used. But also, I agree with what Yair just said. It's, of course, also a question of values, because as long as there is this imperialist structure and as long as the Zionist entity exists, we will be faced with such challenges, because effectively even this cyber spying is just a digitalized form of different forms of spying that the Zionist entity has been employing for so many years, such as the conventional spying, where they would spy and conduct targeted assassinations against people. And these days, these things take place rather in online spaces. But there needs, of course, to be a continuous effort from within the resistance axis and from the resistance to counter these efforts, and of course, to remain aware of them.
Well, Ramiro, why aren't we seeing more of a stronger reaction from Western governments? Because also some of them have been targeted. We saw that Emmanuel Macron of France, of course, was one of those that was targeted. And I mean, we have seen the reports coming out about Saudi Arabia and UAE, these authoritarian countries like this using it to silence dissent. So these countries that at least try to say that they support human rights, some of these Western governments, why aren't we even hearing anything coming out of, for example, Washington or London in condemning this spyware?
I think Washington and London will never condemn any of the crimes of Israel and the Zionist entity because it falls in line exactly with their foreign policy goals. When we're talking about the victims of these cyber attacks in the Middle East, we have, you know, targeting against Palestinians, against people in Yemen, against people in Afghanistan, Iran, and then in Latin America as well, you know, you have journalists, activists, academics in Mexico, Colombia, Honduras, countries that are neo-colonies of U.S. imperialism. All of that benefits the interests of Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange. And this is the new level and the new frontier of the war in the 21st century. We're no longer in the era of frontline soldiers and infantry combating each other. We're in a communicational war, a digital war of data, where if you have more data and information from your enemy, you can control them more. You can even predict their behavior. The technology with AI and algorithms is so advanced that you can manipulate a whole society into believing something that is not true. And so I think the reason why the Western countries will never call out Israel is because they're in fact collaborating with Israel to use this technology against their enemies, against their oppressors, and they're using this as a way to enter the next frontier of imperialism in the 21st century. And it's something that's very scary, and that's why I'm very proud of countries like Iran and Russia and China and others in the anti-imperialist bloc that are developing independent technology, because the second you agree to use their infrastructure, their technology, their apps, you're making yourself vulnerable to their exploitation, to them surveilling you if you speak out against them. And so it's so important for us to develop the next level of defense, a frontier, our own technologies, our own applications. And I think that's what it's going to take.
Daniel, what do you think about as for the possibility of a grassroots global movement in trying to get this type of spyware to be banned or to be deemed illegal? The possibility of that side of things?
As long as governments are continuing to use the spyware, I don't see much probability of that. Of course, now there is an awareness of the spyware, but still, like, even in the Western media, it hasn't been the Israeli role in it hasn't been as highlighted as much as it could have, and it has continued to be used by governments that, as you said, at least pretend that they are interested in human rights. While at the same time, of course, it also serves the Zionist regime to connect with its newfound allies. It has sold the software to the regimes in Saudi and Bahrain and UAE and so on, who don't even pretend that they care about human rights. So effectively, I do not think that could lead to the software being banned. And even if the Zionist regime has been promoting itself as a technological hub, as a very advanced digitalized entity, so I wouldn't be surprised if they have other softwares, if they're already developing other things that they can use to continue spying on. And as long as they have Palestine as a testing ground, as a laboratory, where they are abusing Palestinians to develop all sorts of technologies, I do not see that there is a potential end to that coming from even from grassroots, as long as it's in the Western imperialist framework.
Well, what about that, Ramiro? Daniel just talked about the Zionist regime and how it, even with the spyware, they're using it to try to promote themselves, like they are above the rest. We know they use, from a military perspective, they use a lot of propaganda to say that they're the strongest and the most moral. And now in dealing with technology, it's as if they want to say, we are superior, we are above the rest, and sort of an intimidation factor. What can be done about this? And what do you think about resistance media and the role of basically educating people to what's going on? Your take on what needs to be done on that side of things.
I think that's such a great point. One of the talking points of the Zionists is that Israel is a free, is paradise. You can do whatever you want. They boast about engaging in behavior, decadent behavior, in behavior that's immoral and behavior that is against traditional values. And Israel posits itself as a land of high-tech freedom, of unlimited access to whatever you want. And even within the internet realm, we also see the same thing happening with a lot of the adult content that a lot of Israeli companies have been supporting in the United States and the Western Hemisphere, that they're strongly connected to that. And it's something that is really hard for us in my generation, especially as a millennial, to really understand, because when they compare themselves to more traditional countries, Islamic countries that are preserving morals and values, that are not engaging in this online behavior, they make it seem as if they're better. And that's part of the chauvinism and the arrogance of Israel. They say that they're free, they're advanced, they're in the future, but they make a false equation of being advanced and high tech with being decadent, with being lewd, with being all sorts of kind of things. And I think it's important for a new culture to emerge online that is not based on lewd adult content, that is not based on some of the arrogance, on the decadence that we see on social media and on media platforms in general that highlight gross wealth and fame and luxury cars. We have to create a new culture and a new technology based around families, based around traditional living, based around anti-imperialism, preserving our way of life aside from the empire. And okay. I think that this is the only way out.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this program. Author and researcher Danielle Jedrick out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَيَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّمَا نُمِدُّهُمْ بِهِ مِنْ مَالٍ وَبَنِينَ
Do they think that what we extend to them of wealth and children?
نُسَارِعُ لَهُمْ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ بَلْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ
Is because we hasten for them good things, rather they do not perceive.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about 54th verse of chapter Mu'minun. فَذَرْهُمْ فِي غَمْرَتِهِمْ حَتَّى حِينَ Leave them in their overwhelming ignorance for a time. You may remember that the concept under discussion was causing division, which was a great disaster, and it had a long history. So those ignorant people could not be guided. They somehow refused to accept the truth intentionally, because as the other verses of the Holy Quran suggest, when they heard the truth, they thrust their fingers into their ears, they covered themselves with their garments, and they persisted and magnified themselves with pride. So as a result, فَذَرْهُمْ فِي غَمْرَتِهِمْ the Almighty Allah tells His Prophet to leave them in their overwhelming ignorance, and this is the worst kind of misleading. This is when Allah leaves man to his own devices. Anyway, in the 55th verse, the Almighty Allah says, يَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّمَا نُمِدُّهُمْ بِهِ مِنْ مَالٍ وَبَنِينَ Do they think that what we aid them with wealth and children, the next verse continues, نُسَارِعُ لَهُمْ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ بَلْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ We are hasting unto them of good things? Nay, they do not perceive. So, they somehow, these ignorant ones, evaluate themselves and others only on the basis of wealth and offspring. And this indicates lack of common sense. The previous verses talked about the danger of being ideologically obstinate and misled. And these obstinate groups and parties who have these tendencies are obsessively attached to their ideas. They get a great deal of pleasure from the thought of their ascription to their particular belief system and try to close their minds to any other attempt at investigation and inquiry into other religions.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أنتم الفقراء
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
These two verses mention a part of other aspects of their self-conceit, because the Quran says, أيحسبون, do they think, أنما نمتهم به من مال وبنين, that what we aid them with wealth and children, نسارع لهم في الخيرات, we are hasting onto them of good things? Do they think that having a great deal of property and offspring are proofs of rightfulness? This is the sign of them being on the right path and a sign of their spiritual greatness and closeness to the Almighty Allah's mercy? Nay, بل لا يشعرون. It is not like that. The verse announces they do not perceive. بل لا يشعرون. They are not aware that their very wealth and children are a kind of punishment and chastisement. It's a means of trial. This is a beginning of their retribution. They are ignorant to the possibility of the fact that Almighty Allah might be giving them all kinds of blessings and favor in abundance, so that the chastisement to it will become more painful for them. It is a fact that if the doors of grace are closed to man, he will be more able to suffer troubles and deprivations. But this is not the case when he is used to a life of comfort and luxury, because in that case, even the smallest deprivation can be very excruciating for him. We all have experienced the cases where we have loved something or someone, and when that thing or that someone has been taken away from us, we felt that somehow a part of our body had been taken away from us. But this abundance of blessings usually thickens the veils of ignorance and conceit before the eyes of the evil and arrogant persons, to the extent that they cannot return to the path of truth. The Arabic word numiddu is derived from the word imdad, which means to take the deficiency of something perfect and to prevent something from ending. And the verse that says, أَنَّمَا نُمِدُّهُمْ بِهِ مِنْ مَالٍ وَبَنِينَ, we aid them with wealth and children, means that we are giving them these things in abundance, but they do not understand that these are for their own chastisement. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the World with Reporters.
Environment and energy ministers from the group of 20 rich nations have gathered in Italy's southern city of Naples for a two-day summit on environment, energy and climate change. The talks, chaired by Italy, which holds the rotating annual presidency of the G20, have reportedly been inconclusive so far, as officials are struggling to find common ground to put together joint statements on the topics being discussed. On Thursday, Naples saw a number of anti-G20 protests being staged in different parts of the city. In the morning, hundreds of protesters tried to break into the building where the meeting was taking place. Activists from the campaign group Avaaz, wearing masks depicting Argentinian soccer player Diego Armando Maradona, staged a protest calling for debt relief for developing countries.
People are sick and tired of being lied to. Once again, it looks like there will be a complete lack of any commitments and money. The richest countries are telling the poorest countries we need to protect the environment, and the poorest countries are saying we need money for that.
The largest anti-G20 rally was held on Thursday afternoon in the historic center of Naples. Thousands of people from all walks of life shouted slogans against corporate greed and the influence of governments, and in support of a counter G20 summit. Speaking at the G20 ministerial meeting, Italian Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani said everyone wants to be green without making the necessary sacrifices. The minister added that if the financial system won't change in favor of sustainable development, there will be catastrophic consequences for future generations.
The Naples G20 meeting is seen as a key intermediate stage ahead of global climate talks known as COP26, UN Climate Change Conference. The meeting is to be held in Glasgow, UK, in November. Max Civili, Rome.
The long-awaited Olympic Games officially kicked off in Tokyo on Friday after a one-year postponement due to the coronavirus pandemic. The opening ceremony took place with no spectators in attendance and a reduced number of athletes joining the parade. Only fewer than 1,000 VIPs and officials were present at the Tokyo's National Stadium. The International Olympic Committee has banned foreign and domestic spectators for the first time in the history of the Olympic Games. Meanwhile, athletes, support staff, and media are subject to strict COVID-19 protocols. Most world leaders decided not to participate in the event. Also, top sponsors have stayed away, highlighting strong opposition to holding the event in COVID-fatigued Japan. Tokyo is battling a surge in coronavirus infections and is under emergency measures. Daily cases in Tokyo are currently at their highest in 6 months. The Japanese capital logged nearly 2,000 new daily infections before the official opening ceremony. Japanese officials have vowed to hold safe and secure games despite the lingering pandemic. However, a largely unvaccinated Japanese public is worried that the global gathering of 11,000 athletes could trigger a super spreader event. Earlier this week, the chief of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee said they are not ruling out canceling the games as more athletes pulled out after testing positive for COVID-19. So far, over 100 people linked to the games have tested positive for the virus. A survey by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper says around 70% of Japanese people believe that Olympic organizers are not able to contain coronavirus infections. For weeks, there have been calls for the already postponed games to be cancelled amid the rise of COVID-19 cases in Tokyo and elsewhere across the world. Hundreds of people gathered outside Tokyo's National Stadium ahead of the Olympic opening ceremony, while others demonstrated near the Tokyo government building to demand the cancellation of the event. However, the International Olympic Committee has rejected the idea of calling off the event. The committee could lose billions of dollars in broadcast rights if the games were cancelled. That could be a blatant example of choosing money over people's lives.
Every day, Inos gets on the boat with her younger siblings to help their family with herding their water buffaloes. To them, it's an everyday hobby to play with what they call black monsters, a hobby that is about to turn to ashes. Their bulky playmates are now dying of thirst in an unprecedented drought that has devastated the buffalo's habitat.
Every day we lose two or three of our buffaloes and sheep because there is no water, and this water over there is sour and polluted and is toxic to the animals.
This has been the case for thousands of residents in Iran's province of Khuzestan, who have for the past days been protesting over what they call mismanagement of water resources. Khuzestan is inhabited predominantly by Iranian Arab tribes who live on agriculture and animal farming, which have now been devastated by the worst drought in half a century. Heads of tribes have over the past days been acting as mediators between the protesters and authorities, asking the demonstrators to calm down while urging officials to solve the problems.
We lost our farms and livestock in the drought. We need our rivers and marshlands to be filled with water for our businesses to be up and running again.
Every day the scale of the disaster grows and we are paying the price. Our demand is legitimate. The authorities need to do something before an irreversible catastrophe takes place.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stepped in and called on authorities to speed up their efforts to tackle the crisis.
استعدادهای طبیعی که در این استان وجود داره با این همه کارخانجاتی که در این استان وجود داره و از مردم به جایی برسه که اونها رو ناراضی کنه و ناراحت کنه اونها رو مسئله آبشون مسئله فاضلابشون.
Over the past week, delegations from the government and other entities have been visiting the affected areas to review the situation. In one of its latest measures, the government opened the valves of Karkhe and Dez dams, which have partly filled the riverbeds.
Water is starting to trickle into the riverbeds, raising hopes that life will once again return to the dried land. However, residents here say the crisis is far from over, and authorities need to find a permanent solution to the issue. Yusuf Jalali from the outskirts of Bostan, in the province of Khuzestan.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, groups of people would try to
tried to fabricate him or character assassinate him with all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him it's very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages.
The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten, or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice, in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism, and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved the second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis, Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after Number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They are there to protect big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Signing for Is Up, London.
For thousands of years, the Nile River has meant life to people in a largely arid region.
But today, the river is associated with an endless dispute. Ethiopia said on Monday that it had attained its second-year target for filling a megadam on the Blue Nile, the Nile River's main tributary. The country said the plant may start generating power in the next few months.
We are now putting the turbines of what we call Unit 10. As soon as some important works are completed in a few months, it's all about connecting it to the transformers. And this will provide the biggest outcome of this work for the people of Ethiopia, which is generating electric power.
The project, called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has been at the center of a regional dispute since Ethiopia broke ground on the project in 2011. Egypt, a dry land home to nearly 100 million people, depends on the Nile for 97% of its water supply. And Sudan views the dam as a threat to its own dams and water stations, but Ethiopia deems the project essential for its development. A decade of negotiations under the auspices of the African Union has failed to result in a deal on the dam's filling and operations. The UN Security Council met earlier this month to discuss the project, but Ethiopia later slammed the session as an unhelpful distraction from the AU-led process. Experts say foreign powers' intervention throughout the years has only aggravated tensions in the region and that an African approach to the problem is needed.
I think the problem is the intervention of the imperialist countries, particularly the United States, at this stage. So what has to happen is a more pan-African approach to this problem. Sudan and Egypt should sit down with Ethiopia and negotiate a policy which will benefit all three countries.
Once completed, the $4 billion project will produce more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, doubling Ethiopia's power output. This is significant for an economy that frequently faces electricity shortages and is sometimes hobbled by power rationing. But Egypt considers the dam as a threat to its existence, and Sudan has warned that millions of lives will be at great risk if Ethiopia unilaterally fills the dam. Is a war between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia brewing on the Nile? The next few months might show if tensions explode into yet another hot conflict in the war-stricken continent.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in central Europe, the floods you've mentioned, the droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
documentary film Life Among War Flags, which focuses on Afghanistan and the Taliban, directed by Mohsen Islamzadeh and produced by Press TV, has been unveiled in Tehran in the presence of the filmmakers. The documentary movie Life Among War Flags narrates a different story of conflicts between armed groups in Afghanistan. Moreover, it has made research on the role of the Afghan government in such conflicts.
I have been making documentaries for about 17 years now. The Life Among War Flags depicts the story of people whose region is controlled sometimes by the Taliban, sometimes by Daesh, and sometimes by a central Afghan government and the U.S. forces. I believe they are the main victims of the war in Afghanistan. Making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group. The documentary film Life Among War Flags takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the U.S. and some of its Western allies, including the U.K., have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming it as, quote, fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached to the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering a doubts and questions on Islamic beliefs.